What's up, guys? I'm Dmitry Lipinski, and welcome to the Roofing Insights podcast, the show that lets you take roofing insights on the go. If you have ever wanted to enjoy Roofing Insights content on your drive to the job site or while you're at the gym, this podcast is perfect for you. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. For this episode, we have Earl Word, the Vice President of Exterior Contractor Alliance in-house. Earl has worked in the roofing industry since 1989, and he is here today to cover a wide array of topics, including a controversial subject of why prices for roofing products continue to increase even though oil prices have plummeted in the recent years. But before we get into that, I wanted to introduce you to today's sponsor, Signpost. Signpost helps contractors to get more reviews on the internet by automating your process with your clients. If you want to see how Signpost can boost your company's online reviews, reach out to our friends at Signpost by visiting their website. Packages start as low as $199 a month. Once again, that's signpost.com. Make sure to tell them that Dmitry at Roofing Insights sent you. All right, let's get into the show. You're a perfect guest to have conversation about distribution, supplier world, roofers, and manufacturers. You were first rep for Roof Depot in 89. That's crazy. And let's talk about that relationship. So you started at Roof Depot. You guys sold it in 2006. I want to know a few things. I want our audience know about that end of the industry. What drives prices? And I want to start with the prices for shingles. Recently, they almost doubled in the last decade. It's commodity product. What roofers want to know and cannot comprehend or understand why every year we're getting all the letters of price increases from Beacon, ABC. Price keeps going up regardless of oil prices. It never goes down. It always goes up. And we're a commodity business. But in commodity world, the price for metals, for asphalt, goes up and down, supply and demand. Why it's not happening in the roofing industry?
Boy, that's a complex question, and it'll require a little bit of time and patience. And I've studied this. After I should also say, after we sold the business, I had an opportunity to be president and CEO of a roofing distribution cooperative called Nemion, which Roof Depot was a part of. For smaller to mid-sized United Products here in the Twin Cities was also part of that. And one of my duties there was to study just that question, you know, where is pricing? You know, we did a lot of forecasting. We wanted our distribution members to know where pricing was going so they could be ahead of the curve. Distributors make money off of buying low and selling high, obviously. You know, they certainly wanted to be on the cutting edge of information in the marketplace, and my job was to deliver that to them. So I've spent a lot of time researching what drives pricing in the industry, and frankly, it's complex, and a lot of times it does not make sense. But to go back to that 2008 question, you know, we've seen shingles double in price, and what happened? To me, there was kind of a perfect storm, and it wasn't a bad thing for the industry. In fact, I think it was one of the best things that happened to our industry. Two or three things happened at one time. I'll start off with the acquisition of Elk, if you remember Elk Shingles, by GAF, which was in, I think it was in around 2007. Elk had the technology of producing a low-cost laminate. They were the first manufacturer that just eliminated three tabs. They only made a laminate shingle. That was their focus, and they developed methods of producing that shingle that were very you know, that where they were the low-cost producer. Elk also was kind of the maverick in the industry. If they wanted to take market share in any marketplace that we're involved in, they were strong in the West Coast, they're strong kind of in the Southeast, they could do it because their cost of producing a shingle was much less than the other shingle manufacturers that had kind of antiquated processes, antiquated equipment and such. So when GAF acquired Elk, they kind of took that maverick out of the marketplace, you know, that manufacturer that, you know, we're going to take share, we're going to do it on price and nobody's going to stop us attitude. So that was kind of the first thing. And GAF also acquired that, you know, that technology, that low-cost technology. And that was about the same time you started to see weights and shingles dropping, you know, fairly dramatically. You know, when I was in distribution, we used to get, I think, 12 or 13 pallets on a truck. All of a sudden, one day, we started to get 14 pallets and 15 pallets on a truck. Same weight, just more pallets would show up on a truckload of shingles. And
what was driving that? Just the profit margins? Just, I mean, that's a big difference.
Yeah.
Well, 10-15%.
If you talk to GAF, you know, that they will say that you know, kind of like, well, you look at me and you look at you, you know, fat and muscle. You know, they took the fat out and kept the muscle in the shingle. That was one of their, you know, sales advertisements as to why the weight was going down. When you look at companies like IKO at the other time, they were promoting the fact that their shingles were heavier. I know, you know, I'm not on the technical end of the shingle industry. You know, I know there's fillers. You know, I think when shingles went to fiberglass versus organic, you would rather than soak, you know, the organic mat, which is basically cardboard in asphalt with fiberglass, you would encapsulate that fiberglass tube, you know, around asphalt.
But asphalt is also the most expensive ingredient of the shingle.
Yeah, it's about 33% of the cost of a shingle, from what I understand. And yeah, it can be the most expensive and the most volatile because it's closely tied to petroleum. Yes. Although it does not follow what we see at the gas pumps on a day-to-day basis, and there's a whole history behind that too. But you know, when Elk acquired, or when GAF acquired Elk, they acquired that low cost and they took the Maverick out of the marketplace. And around 2000, I want to say it was 2008 or 2009, somewhere in that, one of those summers, 2008, that's when you saw shingle prices and you were in the roofing industry. It was very aggravating for you, I'm sure. But we were selling shingles for around 45, 50 bucks a square for a laminate shingle. And by the end of the summer, our pricing was up around $80, $90 a square, virtually doubled in about a 90-day period of time. At that point in time, we did have a crisis and a shortage of asphalt.
$140 per barrel, price
went up. Price went up. Asphalt is about 0.5% of the petroleum industry. And through you know, through refinement methods, the petroleum industry has figured out how to make less asphalt. Asphalt in the old days, when I got in the industry in 1980, was a byproduct. You could not control the asphalt supply. It just kind of happened. It's literally the bottom of the barrel. Yeah. And you couldn't control it. And there were times when manufacturers were just dumping asphalt in fields because they had nowhere to put it. And then there were times when there were immense shortages of asphalt. So it's always been this kind of this volatile product. But somewhere in the mid-80s into the 90s, petroleum manufacturers, you know, realized that you could kind of crack those molecules and extract more petroleum product and less asphalt out of, you know, out of a barrel of oil. And they started to get in a position where they could control the supply of asphalt. They can make more asphalt or less asphalt through their refining methods versus just being a byproduct and having to sell it in open market, whatever the market would bear at that time. So they started saying, okay, today we're going to make more asphalt or today we're going to make less asphalt. But when you saw petroleum go up to $140 $1,000 a barrel. Asphalt went from about $350 a ton to over $1,000 a ton in about a 30-day period of time. Wow. And there were some shortages on that, which
that's what drove the price.
That's what drove the
plus
price.
Plus probably delivery freight cost too, because the gas was $4.
Exactly. Yeah, everything went up, and the pricing went up substantially, and it was quick. It was aggravating for contractors. I was out of the distribution business at that end, and I was working for CEO of a roofing cooperative. And just a little bit of funny story that kind of leads into, you know, what I think this did to our industry a little bit. I got a call one day from an old roofing contractor friend of mine, and we were friends by this time. I wasn't selling him materials anymore, and he called me and he spent about 10 minutes on the phone just bitching at me, just screaming about how, you know, everybody's screwing me on price. Distributors are crooks. Manufacturers are crooks. Everything's going up in price. All my customers are mad at me because I can't honor my contracts, and life sucks, and my crews are mad at me, and everything is going wrong. And then he said, "But Earl, I've never made more money in my life." And the reason being is, and like we talked about a little bit on the phone the other day, a high tide raises all boats. And what that means is, you know, the roofing, you know, roofing tends to be a non-discretionary purchase, which means if you need a roof, and roofs last about 20 years, maybe less, maybe a little bit more, but about 20 years, if the roof starts leaking and you need a roof, you need a roof, you need it now. And it doesn't matter if it's $15,000 for that roof or $20,000 for that roof, you need a roof. And it's not the kind of purchase that the consumer makes every day. So they generally speaking don't know that the roof they're paying $20,000 for today was maybe 10 years ago or 5 years ago or last year, $15,000. All they know is they need it. How much is it? How am I going to pay for it? And, you know, and maybe in a store marketplace, they see some of these things, but, you know, as far as pricing going up because they've had multiple roofs and they have to pay deductibles and such. But generally speaking, a consumer doesn't know. And, you know, they need it. They need it now. How much is it? How are we going to pay for it? That's all they care about. So, you know, if you're a contractor, well, first of all, I'll go back. If you're a distributor and you're selling a shingle out the door for $50 a square, and you can put four houses or five houses worth of product on a boom truck and send it on the road, and let's say it's $12,000 for four houses, $3,000 each, going down the road, $12,000, make a delivery, come back, do it again in the afternoon. All of a sudden, pricing went from $50 to, let's say, $80 or $90. Now that truck going down the road is $20,000, and it's the same amount of space. It's the same. You're paying the driver pretty much the same. Gas is about the same price, and all of a sudden, your revenue is up. So if your margins remain relatively the same,
the volume is up.
Yeah. So remember also what happened in 2008. We had the housing crisis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're in the drywall industry, your price dropped by about 30-40%, and your volumes dropped by about 70%. You got creamed. If you're in the roofing industry, the pricing of the raw materials went up almost double. And because roofing is a non-discretionary, we still had storm damage. Roofs are still wearing out. Housing starts went down substantially, but that was kind of replaced by storm damage and other things. So our business may have dropped 20% overall, but shingles went up. So when you looked at the total volume of dollars, it was actually more. So the best industry to be in the construction, you know, related during that time was roofing. Owens Corning as a public company, Beacon as a public company, did pretty well. If you looked at U.S. Gypsum is a great example. They went 24 or 25 quarters in a row of losing money. Owens Corning's operating capital went from an average of 3-5% prior to 2000 and let's say 2005, 2006, to in the 20% range, and it's still there today. You know, it's a public company. You can look up to see, you know, see how they perform. Beacon has some other drivers. Their revenues and volumes went up. Their operating capital, their EBITDA, you know, margins remained in the 4-6% range, and I think they're maybe a little bit better today. And the reason being is there's a lot of competition from NABC Supply, for instance. SRS entered the marketplace around 2010. You know, they're all vying for that contractor business, so their sales went up, their revenues went up, which is a good thing. Their margins remained relatively the same. They didn't go down. So, you know, they ended up, you know, covering their operating expenses faster and making ultimately more profit. But if you looked on a percentage basis, their margins really have not increased, you know, but their revenues increased because those truckloads leaving the yard had more dollars on them. Margins stayed the same. So it was a good thing. At the contractor level, if you were selling a house for $12,000 and now it was $15,000, $18,000 for that same house, it was still non-discretionary. They still needed it. Insurance companies were still paying for most of it. And if a roofing contractor was smart and didn't lower his pricing, which most of you guys are, then you were making more money on it, you know, per roof. So again, I'll end where I started. High tide raised all boats, and it was not a bad thing. We have not seen those prices come down, and I think a lot of that has to do with the attitude of manufacturing distribution, which distribution went back to manufacturing when we did start to see a relaxing in pricing and said, don't you dare lower prices. Because
what drives prices now? Well, because now here's what's happening on a contractor end. You have 3-4 price increases per year. But you have three major players. You have ABC, Beacon, SRS, few minor players. There's not a lot of competition on the supplier end, but on a contractor end, you have 3,000 contractors.
Just you have 40,000 in the United States by my count.
Yeah, but I'm talking about in each city.
Yeah, 3,000, probably close to 3,000 here in the Twin Cities.
Exactly. Absolutely. So you have 3,000 contractors. When 3,000 contractors get 3-4 prices increases, like, we don't increase prices 3-4 times per year.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, a lot of contractors still charge what they were charging 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, like going rate is kind of like, you know, 350, 450, whatever it is for each market, like somewhere up north, it'll be 450, somewhere down south, it'll be 300.
Right.
And it always puzzled me. I would meet business owner who'd been in business for, you know, 30 years. And I'm like, what were you charging in 90s? And you know, 300 a square, like in a decade, they would not increase their price. And the reason is competition.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Chalk in a Truck charges that, when majority of your competition charges that, yeah, you can build a brand, you can do better presentation, you can do, but the problem I see that contractors, there's no way in hell can increase price 3 times in a year.
Mm-hmm.
What drives suppliers increase prices 3 times a year now?
Okay, well, first off, I don't know, like, the announced increases right now are like 7%. And, you know, what's driving the increases now is a supply and demand imbalance. It really started with COVID last year. And the fear of the unknown shut down a lot of factories. Distribution stopped buying product. You know, I've heard distributors were telling their purchasers, if you buy one more truck of shingles, I'm going to fire you. So nobody was buying anything. Nobody knew about this time last year, maybe a month from now. Really, nobody knew what was going to happen. But some very interesting things happened. I think, you know, if you look at the consumer, the consumers now were staying home. They weren't traveling. They weren't having weddings or graduations. They had nothing to do. So let's fix up the house. I remember early on in COVID, I just bought a condo going to a Menards, and I couldn't find a parking spot. Because everybody was fixing up all those little things in the house. And the contractors during that time, it took them about literally 2 weeks to figure out how to use all the technologies out there to, you know, start to, you know, go touchless on their estimates. The estimates are on the outside of the house. You really don't have to be in front of the consumer. You want to build that relationship. So that's always what we've done. But you could send PDFs, you know, you can sign contracts by email, you know, using DocuSign. They adapted all these things that were already out there, put it in a nice package and said, we're touch-free, we can still do your roofs. And the consumer said, great. Well, all this time, distribution and manufacturing weren't buying any shingles, but contractors were actually selling more shingles. Mm-hmm. Because consumers, that the ones that were still fortunate to have a job.
A lot of storms.
Yes, and we had storms. And like I said, non-discretionary. The need was still out there. Your roofs still wear out. COVID, you know, doesn't care if you need a new roof or not, you know. And so we went about 2 or 3 months where supply wasn't keeping up with demand. And it really took the industry until probably, I'd say, mid-June or July to go, oh, my God, roofers are still buying. Now we're out of inventory. Let's ramp this thing up again. And frankly, because of the buying habits of distribution, that where they kind of went to this just-in-time inventory attitude about 5, 6, 7 years ago, versus before this, before 5, 6, 7 years ago, there were these things called winter buys, where distribution would stock up in the wintertime to beat all those increases. They'd still try to get you to, you know, pay the increases, but they'd beat all the increases by stocking up. They would literally buy 6, 8 months of shingles in January, February, March. You know, use your employees that weren't doing anything, have them on load trucks in the winter, load trucks up in the summertime. You know, that was kind of the attitude. Manufacturers encouraged this. One day manufacturers kind of woke up and went, you know, whether we sell a shingle in January for $40 or in June for $50, we're going to sell the same amount of shingles. So why are we selling all of these cheap shingles in the wintertime and then fighting this, you know, no business in the summer because everybody's stocked up? So they eliminated winter buys. They went to, if you need a truck, buy a truck. And the lead times were typically in our industry somewhere around a week. And distributors who maybe kept 6 months of inventory on the ground all of a sudden went to 90 days, 80 days, 60 days, maybe even less than 60 days, because it helped their turns, helped their churn of money, which they very much appreciate. It's a very high capital business being a distributor versus a contractor. And you know, with lead times a week, why do we have to keep 100 trucks of a color in stock when we can get by with 20 trucks, you know, to make sure we can take care of our members, our
price
customers.
Price increase always starts with manufacturers.
It does always start with the manufacturers. Distributors, you know, distributors may have increased cost of, you know, transportation, of, you know, their payroll costs and such. But manufacturing is, you know, really where the raw materials come into play, where, you know, asphalt, ceramic chips, you know, mat, all of those things, and as we know, asphalt is very volatile. And typically how the industry has always worked is you try to promote a price increase in the wintertime when there's less business. Everybody might complain about it, but nobody's really buying as much. So it's kind of hopefully forgotten about by the time May, June, July gets here, and you've absorbed in your mind the 5 or 10% more that you're paying for materials, and off you go, and business is good, and okay, so I'm paying more for shingles, but I'm selling them for a higher price, so that's okay, and the consumer's still buying them, so that's okay. And I think the other part about the asphalt shingle industry is there's no outside threat. It's the lowest price for how to put a shingle on. Yeah, there's metal roofs, there's synthetic roofs, there's everything else out there, but they're all double in price. There's no threat from China. It's too, you know, shingles are too heavy to put in a barge.
Looks like they're trying. Let's talk about China really quick, because I get a lot of emails, a lot of requests from Chinese suppliers, manufacturers. Do you see Chinese shingles? I see some jobs pictures from Canada. Looks like Chinese are coming to Canada's market.
With shingles?
Yes.
It's a surprise to me.
Yeah, well, and I see they're trying. We're getting samples now. Mm-hmm. They will send you a sample. Mm-hmm. How come China is not a threat yet?
Well, we see this every year at the IRE. There's always kind of a foreign or a Chinese area where they're selling. It's typically been asphalt felts, synthetic felts, maybe nails. Other things like that, where China versus going through private labelers, you know, manufacturers that, you know, are American manufacturers that have their goods come from China. There's always this desire, and I think, by Chinese to want to have that direct relationship with the consumer in the United States. There's a couple websites where I buy photography equipment that you can buy direct from China for, like, I could buy a filter for $20 versus $200, you know. I'm trying to think of the one. Is it Wish? I'm trying to remember.
There's a few of them.
And it comes from China. You got to wait longer, but you can do it. It's pretty good stuff for a lot less money. So there's that desire for Chinese to kind of cut out that middleman, so to speak. But shingles, you know, even at the lesser weight they are today, my thought behind this is a container of shingles is only going to have probably two or three, like a truckload of shingles is, 200 squares, give or take, maybe 220 in this day and age. That's maybe 8-10 roofs. You know, there's not a lot of volume that you can put on a truck, probably less than a container, and they all have to come over in a container. So it's just not feasible. You know, the freight kills you thus far. So they've always been insulated because shingles are heavy. Now, that could change. You know, China's a crazy market and crazy environment, but we've never seen that threat from China, and I don't, you know, maybe we will. And then they're going to have to penetrate this marketplace, and as you know, warranties are a big issue. Are they going to last? You know, you look at companies like GF Owens Corning Certainty, all seven of them out there have, you know, decades invested in research and development. You know, they're making, you know, all shingles have issues, but relatively speaking, they're making a pretty darn good product. Sure. You know, I remember drywall coming from China was a big deal about 8-10 years ago, but the drywall that came in had formaldehyde in it, and it caused a lot of health issues for people buying new homes with Chinese drywall in it. It killed that marketplace. Could something like that happen with China?
The same happened with the hardwood floors recently.
Mm-hmm. Yes, hardwood floors, same thing.
They have a huge, yeah. huge legal issue with the lumber liquidators mm-hmm. because they were produced in China.
Right.
The same thing. A lot of scandals, a mm-hmm. lot of investigations.
Yeah, so it would take them decades, and it always comes down to how much money do they want to lose for how long in order to penetrate this marketplace. And so I just don't know if they have a stock.
Well, my worry is if the price keeps going up, like the market becomes very attractive to other countries. Like I know where I'm from, there are big Russian companies who produce asphalt shingles now, mm-hmm. Similar to Owens Corning. Mm-hmm. But they sell to Europe, they sell to Germany, mm-hmm. and they're trying to come to this market. And the thing is, if the price goes way up, mm-hmm. you know, if we're paying over $100 a square now, and I agree with you, it's not the main cost of the shingle, so it's only one third. So mm-hmm. I think for a roofer, you know, even if you buy a shingle for like $70 or $60, like the same happening right now with Temco, it's $10 cheaper, but the roofers are not jumping over it, even if it's a little bit cheaper, because there's perception why it's cheaper, and mm-hmm. there's builder's grade and there's higher grade.
Right, right. And there's service too, and quality and, yep. and such. You know, Home Depot and Menards and Lowe's have always had a lower price for shingles, but it, you know, you have to go pick it up. They don't have the inventory. They don't have the accessories that, you know, that one-step distribution has.
That was my next question. Yeah. Why companies like Home Depot or Lowe's cannot compete with Beacon and ABC? I mean, they have the capacity. They have yards. And the craziest thing I've seen over the years is ABC would buy from Home Depot because they don't have stock like they would mm-hmm. buy GF.
I would do the same thing. I'd go down with my personal credit card and I'd go to the Home Depot and say, what do you have in stock when there were shortages? Back in, I'd say, 2003, 2004.
Why is that happening? Like,
because you do what you have to do to get
is by. Is it true that Home Depot were losing money on shingles? Because I've seen some of their prices, yeah. and I've heard it so many times that, like, we're losing money on this.
Yeah, that gets into the complexity of the marketplace and of the buy-sell relationship between manufacturers and distribution, Home Depot being a retail distributor or an ABC being a one-step distributor, and you have two-step distribution, which really services like a prime source would service the outstate small lumber yards and smaller marketplaces. So there's really three different customer groups for manufacturers. Home Depot may in the spring, we saw it every year, and I used to fight this tooth and nail with manufacturers, particularly like a GAF. You know, I'd be selling a shingle for $70 and Home Depot would offer it for, you know, $20 a bundle or whatever it was. So they'd be $10 at least below us.
But it wouldn't be on GF, it would be on Home Depot.
It would be on Home Depot, and I had a lot of discussions over the years with GF that swears that it's just the way Home Depot chooses to do business, and it's not them selling them, you know, for less money. But if you look at, I always thought it kind of ironic in the industry that Home Depot at the time, I don't know where their volumes are now, but they were around $75 billion as a retail do-it-yourself store type of a thing. ABC Supply was the largest building materials distributor in the country, and they're like $8 billion. They're like nothing. So, Home Depot, even though any one store may not buy more than maybe 50 trucks of shingles a year, they have 1,000 stores. So you do the math, and it's a great customer for GAF or One Scoring Certainty or whoever. And yeah, there are times when they want to get you in the store, so they'll use those as loss leaders. Generally speaking, their accessory items are not up to par. They don't have, they'll stock four or five colors. You have to special order everything else. They have delivery charges on top of everything. You can't get deliveries when you want them. But that number is out there, and it kind of regulates where one-step distribution can sell, because it can't be too far above Home Depot, where the consumer is going to go to Home Depot and put up with all the BS, the less service and everything. So, we try to, and there are times when Home Depot and Roof Depot at my old company, we were about the same price, but it was always kind of maybe in the spring and the fall, you would see, I'd have, contractors would come in with the Sunday flyer and point at it, and I'd go, what do you want me to do? If you want to go pick them up out in their yard, wait in line, and you got your choice of three colors, go ahead. But, I'm going to get you whatever you want tomorrow, 8 a.m. on the roof, with my boom truck. And, but at the same time, we'd have to lower price on occasions to keep some business because of Home Depot.
Is it true that Home Depot, Menards, Lowe's have different badges of shingles, or it's always the same? Because I hear contractors say all the time, it's not the same shingle.
I had a contractor come in one day. We were talking about Royal Sovereigns, and he was thoroughly convinced that the Royal Sovereign that he would got at Home Depot was not the same as a Royal Sovereign. And look at it from GAF's point of view. They're in the same package. If they did that and it was found out, what do you think would happen to,
the brand?
I mean, there'd be lawsuits all over the place. It's the same product. GAF does not make a shingle, or Owens Corning, or anybody doesn't make a shingle saying, this is going to Home Depot. The only time I've ever seen that is Menards. IKO used to privately for Menards.
Atlas does the same thing, Castlebrook.
Yeah, Castlebrook. And they say, I don't know if they do anything different with that shingle or not, but they do put it in a different wrapper, and it's a different marketing and such. And they probably, do some things to make that more, a less expensive shingle, to do the specifications of a Menards. But no, if it says Royal Sovereign, it's just by chance if it ends up at Roof Depot or Home Depot, they wouldn't dare do that. It wasn't even a question I would have asked the people at GAF when I was in distribution, because it was such a silly thought. But contractors that thought that way, I was in distribution, I kind of shook my head and said, yeah, maybe you're right.
Because the price was different, and we like rebates. I remember buying from Owens Corning shingles from Menards, and they would run that crazy 11%. Mm-hmm. Nobody could touch it. Mm-hmm. Because you could buy like 10 roofs in a week. I mean, 10 roofs, you're talking about 40, 50 grand. 11% is $5,000 back in your pocket.
I know.
Like, I remodeled my entire house, paid for my kitchen, paid for my floors, because it's cash. Yeah. For me, it's a cash, but it's off the
exactly.
table.
Well, you get a credit card with the 11% on it, or you get a piece of paper, what have you. I've sent in a lot of those receipts to get my 11% back, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
But for big items, it's huge. And the same with Home Depot. I was buying GAF shingles from Home Depot in 2015, and nobody could touch it. Nobody could, like manufacturers, other suppliers would not even try to work out their price to match it.
Right.
And I was not paying for deliveries either.
Yeah, well, and you're exactly right. And over the years, I really think what's regulated distribution's pricing more than anything are the big box stores versus what they're buying from the manufacturers or each other. If you look at ABC, Beacon, SRS, and the independents, we all want to make money, when I was in the business. And we all had costs. It's funny, when we sold our business to Beacon Roofing Supply, my cost of doing business, for every dollar I sold, 17% of my cost went to my operating expenses. The trucks, the gasoline, the employees, all of that stuff. Like 75% went to the cost of the product, probably 75 to 78%. And between the 17 and the 78%, what was left, when you do all the math, you know, that was my profit, which was running in the 4 to 6% range. You know, what we actually call net profit. You know, if you're doing $50 million, that's not bad. But boy, you're taking a lot of risks for 5%. A lot of risks in the business. So, you know, but you have to cover your expenses. So you can only go so low. But, you know, purchasing is also very, very sophisticated between a manufacturer and distributor. And there's, you know, a lot of times you as a distributor will live off of incentives. It's the same thing like when you go to buy a car, they're saying we're selling it below invoice. Well, they're not losing money on that car. They're getting a rebate from Ford or Chrysler or GM based on the volume of iron that they move through their stores. Same thing with distribution. The more we sell, the bigger rebates we get. And a lot of times your driver, and there's been many, many times when I've sold things for less than invoice price, knowing I will make it up on the incentives that we'll get by reaching a certain volume. Incentives are huge. There's a sophistication.
Are they similar to incentives to the contractors? The contractors get usually it's up to 4%.
No, the incentives between a distributor and a manufacturer are, you know, they can't be defined in any one similarity, because it might be you might get a local buy, you know, where the local branch manager might get 10% off by bringing in 20 trucks in a day, or 5% off. There may be a regional buy. Winter buys that we talked about that have gone away, national purchases, you know, volume incentives, payment incentives, marketing allowances. There's all these different buckets that all add up, and the sophistication between a manufacturer and distributor is extreme. And when you look at the sophistication between a distributor and a contractor, it's much, much less than that. Much less than that. You know, it's a much simpler sales process between, you know, for a distributor to sell a product versus buying a product. Well, the one thing the distributors do for a manufacturer is provide cash flow. I wouldn't say it's that way, but, you know, the cost of money has been pretty cheap for the last 10, 15 years relative. So, manufacturers offer discounts for distributors to pay their bill fast. And those discounts almost become a function of price, because you don't not take a discount, and a discount might be 1%. Typical terms might be 1% 30 days or 1% 10th of the month, whatever you bought the previous month. And you take those discounts. But if a contractor is not paying his bill to a distributor, you know, they're going to get a call from a credit manager. Can you give me a couple of days? And the credit manager says, sure, I'll give you a couple of days. And or we might need you to pay it down a little bit. But if a distributor isn't paying his bills, the manufacturer will cut him off today. You know, if the bill is late, you just don't do it, because what a distributor provides for a manufacturer is cash flow. Period. End of story. You know, I don't care how long it takes those roofers to pay you. You're going to pay me on the 30th. And for the most part, because of, you know, the distribution's fairly sophisticated, you know, you have borrowing bases and such. Distributors don't dare pay their bills late, period. And that's one of the services of manufacturer.
It's so crazy to hear, because manufacturers always stop their lines. And I've seen it so many times, like, you know, Colorado gets hit every year. And there's always shortages. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a demand, you know you will sell, and you will get paid right away. Mm-hmm. Why don't you go and produce more shingles so you never run out of stock? Right. Because there's always demand. There's always storms.
You're right. And if you look at the past 25, 30 years, ARMA numbers, so Asphalt Roofing Manufacturers Association, they publish, which is kind of freely available, even though it's supposed to be secretive, but they'll publish, they have... Every shingle manufacturer reports in, and they publish volume shipped into distribution on a quarterly basis. You know, the average you know, the ARMA number average over 25 years has been 138 million squares. The high was 175 million, and the low was like 118 million at the low part of like 2010, 2011. So it's been, you know, the line has been kind of like this. It hasn't, there's no spikes. Like, you know, if you look at housing, housing's good right now, but, you know, when you have 2 million housing starts in 2005 and by 2008 you're down to 600,000, I mean, that's a big drop. But roofing, you don't see that.
But why companies Owens Corning every year, like this year, they have huge shortage,
well,
like all over the place.
Because of COVID.
Yeah. But last year, you know, like the same thing. Like, I mean, shortages happen all the time.
Well, the last time we've seen really shortages like this was 2005, when 175 million squares, and it was thought the capacity at that time was about 175 million squares. Now, fast forward to today, capacity is probably somewhere in the 150 million square range, and right now we're going to be pressing between 145 and 150 million squares this year, if everything goes like everybody thinks it's going to go, because housing starts are up, consumer demand is up, and, you know, storms is going to be the kind of the big if. If this is a heavy storm year, yeah, these shortages are definitely going to go through second quarter, probably going to go through third quarter, and if it's a heavy storm year, into 2022, for sure. So, but, you know, I see what you're saying, and you're right. You know, they should be able to predict more. But the reason they don't is because of the volatility of asphalt and raw materials. They don't want to buy asphalt at $500 a ton, make a bunch of shingles at $500 a ton, and then find asphalt goes down to $300 a ton.
I see.
So they...
That's important.
Yeah. Yeah, so they don't carry a lot of inventory. And frankly, from about 2000 and let's say 11 till 2000... until February of 2020, the just-in-time inventory methodology that distribution and manufacturing adapted, you as a contractor in the contractor business never even saw it, because you order your shingles on Monday, they arrived on Tuesday, everything was good. But what we ended up finding out through this whole COVID thing is really how fragile the supply chain is. You know, what could possibly go wrong was always our attitude. Well, now we know what can possibly go wrong. You know, just, you know, acts of God, outside interference, you just don't know what's going to happen. You know, like in you know, maybe some experts saw the housing bubble bursting in 2008 and said, this is not good, but who could have predicted COVID? You know, so, yeah, it certainly is a mess. But hopefully... you know, the high tide still raises all boats. Getting back to pricing, you asked a question, I just want to make sure we cover it. Manufacturers will typically announce a 7%, 5 to 7% increase in maybe March 1st. By the time it, you know, but there's an inventory, you know, pipeline. By the time it gets to the contractor, it's maybe April, May, June. So if they announce it March 1st, typically you'll see a distributor announced like an April 1st increase, you know, just to, you know, give everybody time to adjust and such. It may not go up. What's happened in the industry going back, let's just look at the last 10 years. Let's not even go back 40 years that I've been in the business. Look at the last 10 years. Those increases may or may not happen. You know, demand may not be what everybody thinks it's going to be. Supply may have an overabundance of supply, but you always announce the increases, but sometimes they happen, sometimes they don't. So the industry gets this persona of crying wolf at times. But, you know, the 7% increase might be a 3% by the time it shakes out. You know, and at the consumer level, because ABC wants your business, Beacon wants your business, SRS, all the independents want your business, you may or may not see that. And what happens behind the scenes is, okay, I understand you have an increase, but can you delay it to me, because I'm a big strong distributor, for 60 days, and we'll try to raise it and such. And they'll say, you know, manufacturer might say no, but B might say yes. So. But then A caves in and says yes after a period of time and what have you. So what happens is the increases may or may not happen, but they're always talked about in the spring. So maybe the perception of contractors are the pricing always does go up, but it really doesn't. I kind of followed pricing because of my responsibilities for the past 10 years or so, and we've kind of seen, we saw that spike, And we kind of saw it come down a little bit, but it's kind of gone like this. Now, this year, because of the supply and demand imbalance, I think we are going to see those increases. I think they are going to happen. At least the first round will happen. And you know, the driver behind it is a supply and demand imbalance. It isn't raw materials going up, although we have seen asphalt go up in price. But you know, there's talks of a second in May, and there's talks of even a third in August. We don't know. Best advice I can give any contractor is anytime that you give a price to the consumer, particularly in this day and age, is let them know pricing is volatile because of COVID. You know, only guarantee your pricing on your contracts for 30 days. Say
30 days.
30 days. Just every contract you should be writing should say, this price is good for 30 days. Now, it might be good for 60 days or 90, but I know I can work with my supplier, and make sure you're working closely with your suppliers and have a real understanding of what's going on. A lot of time the suppliers don't know, because we're right now in a situation where everybody thinks that the first increase is going to stick, and we're pretty confident of that. But the second, third, fourth down the road, we don't know. We had a conversation with the Xactimate people the other day because we were having some pricing issues with my group in the Georgia marketplace. The pricing just didn't make sense. And one of our members of our group reached out to us for help. And Xactimate said, if we followed every price increase that's ever been out there, shingles, we'd be pricing shingles at $200 a square. So really what that puts...
But they should consider the price increase. So when manufacturers...
They have to consider them, but that's where I say the industry cries wolf a lot. You know, how do you know it's real? How do you know it's not real? And really,
but do they just, like, let's talk about Xactimate. How often do they increase the pricing based on shingle increase price?
Well, if you talk to Xactimate, they have a whole team of people that are constantly surveying. But where are they surveying? They're typically would be calling a supply desk, ABC supply desk, and those supply desks are going to give them whatever their retail list price is. Typically, which is good for most contractors because, you know, you want that to be a little bit higher than what you're actually paying because most contractors will negotiate off of that retail pricing. And for the most part, it works. And I think they do kind of keep up with it, but they get behind very, very fast. They got slaughtered in 2008, 2009 when shingles doubled in price. No way that they could keep up with that because as good as they might say they are at surveying, they're really not that good because who they call, they're calling the supply desks. Sure. And they're not really talking to the leaders in the industry about what's really going on. And frankly, most contractors aren't either. Most contractors are local contractors. They work within their own local area. And the information they get is generally from their suppliers. You know, that's why, you know, my position has always been, after I left my distribution company, to help keep distribution on the cutting edge of what's really going on macro in the industry. And now I'm working in the contractor world, and it's that same thing, trying to make sure that my contractor group is on the cutting edge of real-time information. But having said that, we still guess, but hopefully our guesses are more educated than, you know, than normal.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Amazon entering the space? There's a lot of talk. Do you see any movements? I know they're trying to partner up with a few big players.
You know, it's funny because I have a consulting business, Earl Ward Consulting. I still have it, but with my responsibilities being more on building this group called Exterior Contractors Alliance that I'm building, I do less and less consulting and only for a few friends in the industry now. But about 2 years ago, right when I was getting involved in ECA, and it was about this time 2 years ago, my phone started ringing off the hook from investor companies wanting to know where Beacon was. Beacon is a public company, what they were doing, what their projections were, and such. I started listening to these investors, and I probably had 10 calls in a week, and it looked to me like there was a rumor going around that Amazon was going to acquire Beacon, and Amazon can acquire Beacon with table scraps. I mean, you know, and, you know, I don't know what Beacon's market cap is, but I haven't followed it that closely, but it's Amazon could buy it out of pocket change.
Like Jeff Bezos.
That's nothing new in Amazon. Amazon is so cash rich that's 1% of their cash maybe or 5% of their cash. And because they wanted to get into that, that building products consumer space, similar when they acquired Whole Foods because they wanted to get into, you know, the grocery business. And then it went away. And apparently it was a rumor, or Amazon took a look at it and said, not ready yet, or what have you. But if Amazon wanted to, they can. And there wouldn't be anything that could stop them in the modern world. I don't know. They may have looked at...
Why Amazon needs Beacon when they can go and do the deal with the supplier?
Well, and that might be
with, what, with the manufacturer.
Right, right. And I haven't done it in a while, but I did go on Amazon maybe... that 2 years ago and just put asphalt shingles in, and they do have some out there. But
what do they sell?
I think it was Malarkey or something. They had something online. I mean, you know, you could
maybe like a test.
I think we'll all probably look at Amazon and see if we can buy shingles from them this afternoon. But
wouldn't try.
Yeah.
Yeah, with my app.
Yeah.
They sell underlayments.
Yeah, they sell a lot of accessory products, but there they are. There's asphalt shingles. Oh, you can buy them. That's. But could they? Yes, if they wanted to. And again, it comes down to when Jeff Bezos will have to look at the building products industry as a whole and say, how much money am I willing to invest, or how much am I willing to lose for how long to capture share? And they certainly, if there's one company out there that could disrupt the supply chain in not only shingles, but in everything building products related, it certainly can be Amazon. Home Depot is very strong. Lowe's is very strong. Menards is strong.
What's your take on that?
And contractors are, just let me finish up that thought. Contractors are used to having credit lines, whereas Amazon, you have to give them a credit card and such. Could contractors adapt to Amazon, or could Amazon adapt to contractors? I don't know. Those are above my pay grade questions.
But we do business with, you know, Home Depot and Lowe's is without credit. And why is so hard for Home Depot to really compete with ABC? I mean, they do have contractor desk. I mean, they deal with materials, and it's just not
there the same. There was a time that they were going to go that way. Back when Bob Nardelli was the CEO, Home Depot started HD Supply, which ironically they just acquired again. HD Supply was going to be that one-step arm of Home Depot. And this goes back about 10, 15 years, as I recall. And you may have noticed in the stores, all of a sudden there are contractor desks showing up in Home Depots at the same time. They really wanted to capture that ABC Supply share. And somewhere along the line, and I'm sure there's an answer out there, I just never looked at it, but somewhere along the line, Home Depot kind of backed out of that business. Are they going to be contractor friendly? Absolutely. You know, but they did not want to make the investment in equipment, boom trucks. You know, they outsource their booms, right? You can get a delivery on the roof from a Menards or Home Depot, but they call a third party to come and bring it out there for them. They didn't want to make the investments. There might have been too, you know, the liabilities might have been too great. They may have looked at, you know, the services one-step distribution was offering and said, we don't want to do that for that money. You know, because as I said, our cost of doing business is about 17%, which whether it was Roof Depot or we sold our business to Beacon, it was our cost of doing business was the same. Scale didn't matter because you can only put so many squares of shingles on a truck and send it out the door. So economy of scale, you know, like what contractors, you know, have, because your costs are mainly variable costs at distribution, your costs are mainly fixed costs. And they probably just didn't want to make that kind of investment for that low of a margin, so to speak, for that 5%. It's my theory.
Can you describe competition between manufacturers for suppliers' business?
Mm-hmm.
How competitive, how fierce it is?
Yeah, and that's a great question, and one that can get me in trouble if I dig too deep into that, because we have very tight relationships with manufacturers. I always have, but I would say it's very sophisticated. I would say that there's, you know, when I got in the business in 1980, there were about 35 shingle manufacturers in the United States. Companies like Celotex and that are gone now, and I can't even remember all of them. Bird and Johns Manville used to make shingles, and there were about 30. Today there's 7, and really 3 of them have 80-85% market share. So it's a very much consolidated business, and if you look at distribution, it's moving towards consolidation. Back when we started Roof Depot, there was no ABC Supply, or ABC Supply was just a small little business in Beloit, Wisconsin. Beacon was just a small little regional distributor in you know, the Northeast. There was no SRS, and you know, we everything was done on a regional basis. There was no national distribution, and everything evolved. And now, there's been a consolidation in both industries, in both the manufacturing and the distribution industry. So there's many, many less players. The relationship between a manufacturer and a distributor is very strong, very tight, very personal, very secretive, is the best way to describe it. And it's still whatever business you're doing business in, and people say this all the time, and it's a cliche. It's a people business. It's a relationship building business, but it definitely is all along the chain. Whether it's a contractor trying to sell to a consumer, or all the way up to the CEO ABC picking up the phone and calling the CEO of GAF and saying, we have an issue. It's all relationship building. But it's complex. The purchasing processes are very complex. It's very sophisticated. The interesting thing I find about the manufacturers, how manufacturers look at like their share, for instance, the manufacturers want to gain share. Yeah, they do. But they don't want to gain share at the risk of margins. And what they learned, and I had somebody tell me in the industry once tell me this, I asked them when they look at the ARMA numbers that come out, what do they see and how do they view those ARMA numbers? And their answer was, if we see we're gaining share, then we feel our prices are maybe too low. So we raise our prices. If we see we're losing share, our prices are too high, so we lower our prices, which tells me that the manufacturers have reached kind of this equilibrium. Everybody's making money. Distribution's not quite there because, distribution is very aggressive to get that contractor business. But the manufacturing level, there's not a lot of movement. The game is played right now between the two 48-yard lines of a football field. You don't see a lot of movement back and forth. Once in a while, something happens. But the relationships are strong. They're stable. And I think they're all necessary to provide the consumer, the contractor, great service, on your end. And frankly, distribution, I think, is in the past 30 years, I would say, has really stepped up their game. And contractors are, have a lot of great choices in distribution out there and get things that weren't offered when I got in the business, like rooftop deliveries and such. Sure. Make your job easier. The barrier to entry on a contractor level is if anything, distribution helps that barrier to entry because they welcome you as a new customer with open arms.
Do you feel like contractors are not outnumbered, mm-hmm. but left behind maybe a little bit? I see a huge consolidation in the distribution, manufacturers, but contractors, we're fighting this fight all by ourselves. There's no unions. I mean, there are unions, but majority of sales, majority of the market is independent contractors who cannot stand each other. They would not be in the room with each other. They don't want to share secrets. There's no buying power. There's no consolidation. Mm-hmm. What you do is very unique to me, and that's one of the main reasons I wanted to talk to you. What can contractors do to have some kind of leverage on the market? Because right now, I don't feel like we have leverage when it comes to pricing. Mm-hmm. We have to deal and adapt mm-hmm. to both suppliers' decisions and manufacturers. Mm-hmm. We cannot go in, it's like, nope, mm-hmm. we're not doing it.
Right. And you have to be on the cutting edge, and typically a contractor is not, because your information is coming from either your manufacturer's rep or your distributor rep, and they're only giving you information that they know. I can't tell you how many times when I was in distribution, a manufacturer's rep, the guy's actually in the field, the boots on the ground, would call me because he wanted to know what was going on in the marketplace.
That's great.
Because they don't know. And actually with consolidation of purchasing nationwide, the relationship between a distributor company and this manufacturer rep, I think, has gotten weaker and weaker. Unfortunately, I think that's very unfortunate about our business because purchasing, is just become more centralized and sophisticated, and that branch manager, for the most part, and ABC is a little bit different, maybe a lot different, but that branch manager who used to be able to make buying decisions now is not. It's all being done corporately, so that sales guy that used to come in and they would share information on what's going on, it's not happening anymore. So, the trickle down to the contractor level just isn't getting there as to what's going on. All you see is price increases, because that's all they want to talk about. But they're not telling you macro why this is a good thing
you know, what's really going to happen, what's the driving behind it. That information really doesn't get to the average contractor unless he goes and really wants to take a peek, you know, take a look at it. But you're absolutely right. By my estimation, and I've studied this part of the business, there's 40,000 contractors in the United States. If you look at the residential side of the business, we'll set commercial roofing aside. That's a little bit different, but not that much. 40,000 contractors, there's virtually no consolidation. There's a little bit here and a little bit there. There's a roll-up out there. But if you look at the distribution side of the business, even the independents are part of cooperative purchasing groups. And then, obviously, ABC is a consolidator, SRS and Beacon. They've all consolidated all these small ma-and-pa companies into these large conglomerates. You know, manufacturing, the same thing. We talked about there were 30 manufacturers. Now there's seven. Three of them have 85% share. At the distribution level, when I got the business in January of 1980, there were probably 20,000 roofers in the United States. Now there's 40,000 roofers. There's no consolidation. If anything, it's more fragmented than it ever has. And I think the barrier to entry at the contractor level is very low. It's really easy. Like I like to say to guys, you know, your salesman of today is your competition of tomorrow in a lot of cases, because, you know, everything is subcontracted. You don't have to inventory products because distribution does that for you. It's very easy to get a line of credit at a distributor, so you don't have to pay your bills right away. So you've got cash flow. You don't have to worry about cash flow, which is the most important part of business, in my opinion. You pay your salespeople and you pay your crews, on 1099, so you don't have to have employees sitting there doing nothing when you don't have the business. And so, and you can operate out of your basement, particularly in this day and age with technology and such. And there's no consolidation. Yet, at the same time, with those 40,000 contractors in the United States, there's a group, maybe 1%, that kind of transcend that. They've ran the gauntlet. They faced all the challenges. They've made all the mistakes in the industry, and their businesses are now very substantial businesses, and they're great entrepreneurs. They're sophisticated, and they realize one thing, that we're either going backwards or forwards, because nobody stays the same in business. And they also realize that there's strength in numbers, and we really need to, like you say, we can't stand to be in a room with each other. I see it kind of differently. I find that our group and I find contractors love to be in the room with each other, because that's where they get their best information. I saw this at Roof Depot. I don't know if you've ever gone to the Roof Depot in Minneapolis. Big, right. Nice, beautiful showroom. That was kind of my idea. I'm proud of that showroom, even though it doesn't exist anymore. But we put a lot of money into that. And kind of one of the unintended consequences or byproducts was we were able to hold, like, lunches where we could turn that showroom into a big lunchroom, because we had all the space inside, and it didn't matter if it was wintertime or it didn't matter if it was raining outside. You know, we had all these picnic tables in the back, and we'd bring them in our showroom, and we would have a pig roast, or we'd have a barbecue and all. And literally, we would have hundreds and hundreds of contractors, and we'd do about one of these a month. What I would walk around as the, you know, owner of the company and the, you know, the managing partner, I'd walk around and I started observing. And what I saw is contractors would call each other and say, "You going to lunch at Roof Depot? Great. Yeah, let's get together." And they would like to sit together and talk and share information. "What are you doing here? Do you got a crew I can borrow? You know, can you help me with a siding job?" And there are those relationships out there. And really, if you look at the Twin Cities, any one contractor, how many times does he really compete with any one other contractor for any one job out there? Because there's so many jobs and so many contractors, it very rarely happens. We have six contractors in our group in the Twin Cities. We have 43 members throughout the United States. We're a small organization just getting going. Six of them are in the Twin Cities. We have six because they all invited each other in, because they all like each other and they all appreciate each other as competition, and they very rarely compete. So I think it's the opposite. I think contractors do.
Well, I think there's a trend towards it. Like, yes. I see the same thing in my community. Yeah. There's a trend, but it not used to be like that.
It didn't. No, I agree. And I can't tell you how many times contractors have walked in my office and said the Effenheimer about other contractors. So I understand that part of it. But I think once you reach a certain level, of business acumen, you want to be around guys that are like-minded, like thinking, because you realize you need to be a sponge, you need to learn from them, and hopefully you have something to give back. And I see that more often. When I was in distribution and I joined a cooperative, our business went from surviving to thriving by the fact that I was in a cooperative and could get together with a guy from Yakima, Washington, and talk about what's the best payroll processing. You know, that was very important to me because I couldn't get that by picking up the phone and calling Brian Bennett with A.H. Bennett or Al Hatfield at United Products because they were competitors. So having relationships with contractors outside of your area through a group is important. And there are groups out there, but our group is the first cooperative set up where it's owned by our membership, and it's really the first time that we can get these guys in a group, and they all have one thing in common. They all are business owners of the same business. They're all in this together. They're all co-owners of this cooperative, so they look at each other as partners more than they look at each other as competitors, and they start to feed off of each other, share best practices, find those that's upper quartiles of those best practices, and all adapt them and become smarter and stronger and more profitable business people.
And everybody wants to know, don't know how to ask, and every contractor probably in a lifetime trying to figure it out. Why contractors cannot buy directly from manufacturers? I have a lot of brand new startups mm-hmm. calling me on consulting calls every week, and it's like, Dimitri, why cannot go straight to GF or Icon, just mm-hmm. stock it? And people think that they will save a lot of money buying direct. I think it's entrepreneurship spirit, cut the middleman, which I don't blame them. Mm-hmm. Explain why it's so complicated and why manufacturers would not do business. If you do $50 million, you still go through middlemen.
Well, we'll go back to what I talked about a little earlier on, that distribution provides for manufacturing cash flow, whereas contractors, DSO, days sales outstanding, is very important at the distribution level. The average in the industry is probably something like 45 days, but there's always a certain amount of bad debt that a distributor has to incur, and I think it's important to note that bad debt also has to be that comes out of their profits, which means they have to raise their price a little bit to cover the bad debt.
What kind of numbers of bad debt have you seen percentage-wise?
Well, I think the industry average is somewhere between 0.25% and 0.5%.
But you run on 5%, so.
It becomes a big deal. It's maybe 10% of your profits are being lost in bad debt. So that's a big deal. I think from a contractor point of view, why that's important is it's important, if you want to elevate the industry and if you're looking at always operating your business above industry standards, pay your bills on time. And if you have and I think one of the things distribution has done a little bit of a disservice, not all of them, and I think this has changed, is they keep contractors in business longer by extending them more credit, helping them get out of debt. I think the most important thing a contractor can do for his business is pay his bills on time. And they should shout that from the mountaintops when they do. We pay our bills on time. When you go into a consumer and you sit down and say, check with our suppliers, they're going to tell you that we're gold. They love us because we pay our bills on time, because that's the foundation. If a contractor is paying his bills on time, everything else will fall into place as far as how he operates.
But if you're doing 15, 20 million, a year, mm-hmm. why can't you go to ICO? Okay. Or?
Good question. I had a contractor back when I had my distribution business come to me, and he wanted to buy direct, and he wanted me to teach him how. He was a customer of mine. Okay, we'll go through this. And I sat down and I actually opened my books up and showed him how I'm paying $300,000 for a boom truck. Okay, I have inventory. I have a building I've put the inventory in. Sometimes inventory gets broken. Sometimes inventory gets stolen. There's all these factors that you have to factor in. Now, I'm servicing 500, 1,000 contractors. So I've got a lot of contractors coming and going. Now, you're only servicing your business, and you're going to do all the things I'm doing. You can't possibly afford to do this. My costs, my expenses of running my business are about 17% of each sale. And that's probably about the industry average. No contractor, if he's only doing this for his business, can do it for that cheap. So now, if you're going to buy direct truckloads, let's say
let's say even GAF would sell you at the same price as a distributor.
Will they?
You know, will they? No. No. I mean, it's a moot question from the beginning, but I'm trying to explain as to why. But let's say that they would. Now, you're not a distributor, you're a contractor. So you're buying these shingles direct, but you're only buying them for what you're going to sell. You're not buying them to sell to every contractor in your marketplace or everyone you can sell to. So what do you do in the wintertime when you bought too many shingles? And you've got to buy truckloads of shingles because they'll only sell truckloads. What if you only need one square to finish a job? You know, you got to buy a truckload. You no longer have that ability to go down to ABC, Home Depot on a Saturday and pick up one bundle of shingles. Now, if you have in your warehouse, great. But now you've got to kind of predict what you're going to sell ahead of time because you got to buy it long before you sell it. And it's easy to do if you're homogenized with 500 to 1,000 contractors that you're selling on a day-to-day basis. But if you're only buying and selling for yourself, you can't do it for 17%, you know, assuming that you're going to buy at the same price. Now, going back to what I said, manufacturers are not going to sell you direct because they don't want to put up with credit headaches. You know, the cash flow is the main thing that a distributor does for a manufacturer. One of the main things, maybe not just the main thing. So you're going to buy from a distributor direct truckloads coming in. Maybe you're going to buy for 10% better, but it's going to cost you probably over 20% to service that business. So when you do the math in your head, which it doesn't take long, you kind of figure out that distribution's giving me a pretty good deal. It may look like I could do better. And there's a few contractors out there that inventory their own shingles, one we just talked about. But I think at the end of the day, distribution has the efficiency and economy of scale that a contractor never can, even at 20 million. No, your typical distribution yard is probably doing somewhere in the range of, at the low end, 10 million, but the distribution yards in the Twin Cities here, for instance, doing 30, 40 million, 50 million out of one yard in sales. So if you're a $20 million contractor, take a third of that. So, you know, let's say $7 million worth of purchases a year. That's, you know, and if you compare that to the 10 yards in the Twin Cities all doing 50 million, that's 500 million. That's a pretty small percentage, and you just can't be that efficient.
Next question about consolidation and what you do. If contractors cannot buy directly from manufacturer because they would not sell it to you, what can we do? If we consolidate, I mean, can we, like, why would we consolidate if we cannot buy direct, if we cannot force pricing? You know, is there going to be leverage if we consolidate? Yeah. Can we dictate our rules? I mean, why consolidate?
Well. First off, you know, dictate's a strong word, but I understand where you're going with that.
Leverage.
With leverage. I think the biggest thing a contractor is missing is market intelligence and a national voice. Contractors don't have a real national voice.
We're the voice of roofing community.
Well, you are, and I'm trying to be. But looking at contractors in general, 40,000 of them, how many are you and I exposed to? Maybe 500 of them or so. So there's no national voice out there. And like I mentioned earlier, they get their information from their reps, and the reps only are going to give them the information that they know, which isn't a lot because that's how everybody
I'm going to interrupt that. You there. Yeah. It's so crazy. You're exactly right, because manufacturers and suppliers know our business like they see the going rates for labor, for materials.
Yeah.
They know what we sell for, right? They see all of it.
They could be a roofer tomorrow. I could be a roofer.
No roofers know how much how much it costs to produce a shingle. I know. Mm-hmm. You know.
I kind of know. I've heard many different numbers out there.
But that's how crazy.
Contractors, it's
secret. It's a top secret. Nobody knows.
Right.
Nobody knows the margins or real margins. Mm-hmm. I mean, we get the idea. Yeah. But you guys know our business. We don't know your business.
Yeah, and because contractors tend to be kind of open books. That's a great point. I never thought about it that way. But, you know, I could. If I'm 59 years old and I don't want to do this, but I could probably start a contracting business tomorrow with what I know, but could I start a distribution business? No, I don't have the capital. Can I start a manufacturing business? No, I know nothing about it, but I could start a contracting business I've never done it before. You know, that's a very good point. But I think getting back to the root of your question, which is a very important question, I think what contractors can do
is what they're missing is a national voice. In other words, somebody that if there's something going on in the industry, that information flows into a central area working on their behalf, and somebody picks up the phone and calls a higher up and says, "We don't like what's going on as a group." Not Fred's Roofing calling and saying, trying to get a hold of the CEO at GAF, Jim Schnepper, and saying, "Jim, I don't like what's going on." Jim's going to go, "Well, thank you, Fred," and he's going to tell somebody to take care of Fred. No, a national voice that's saying, "We're seeing a direction that's not in the best interest of the industry. We need to talk about it." That's not out there. That's out there, but it's not owner driven by contractors. It's just kind of like almost amoebically out there. So I think
I want to ask our audience really quick. Comment below, how much do you think it cost to make asphalt shingle? just a number. Comment below how much you think. Yesterday I talked to ex-rep for Temco, and he was telling me that he knew the cost, and it's about $30. Comment below what you think
costs. We gave the answers to the test already. But
we'll cut it out.
Yeah.
Like you said, you've heard it so many times. I mean, he was a sales rep. He was not a manufacturer. Did he know? Is it 30? I cannot go and make a video. It cost them $30 because I don't know. It could be 20. It could be 40. It could be 15.
Well, the other thing is it could be 30 in the middle of summer when you're operating 24/7, 365. In the wintertime, when you're only operating one shift, but you still have everything, you still have to cover all your base costs, it could be 60. So, it's blended. It's very complicated. Yeah, I'll be interested to see the results of that, too. I haven't even thought about it, what the cost of a shingle. I know that when I got in the business in 1980, actually, no, when I started with United Products in 1986, I think it was, that was my first, we had a menu behind us at the city desk counter. Three tabs were $19.95 a square. That's what we were selling three tabs for.
Wow.
So in 1980. So that's how much that the pricing's changed. But that's a great question. But the ability to you talk about leverage, the ability for the contractor to have collective leverage. I think it's as important or more important for that contractor to have market intelligence so they know where the market's going. Is the leverage going to help save you a few points? Yes, but I think it's more important to be on the cutting edge of where the market's actually going, consumer trends, pricing trends, trends in safety and regulations and such like that. Grouping together, there's not one reason that a contractor should group together with other contractors in some manner. There's thousands of reasons. And kind of like with your business, with my business, there was never one thing I could do to improve my bottom line. Every day I had to do 100 things to improve that bottom line because it's a sophisticated business.
Give a couple of tips to contractors to build better relationships with manufacturers. Let's talk about rebates. Let's talk about those couple points. Mm-hmm. Who, in your opinion, offers the best rebates and how to get it? How to get the best kickbacks, if you will? I see some contractors are doing great. Like I know one contractor who is getting like 4% from certain teeth. Mm-hmm. Some guys have amazing relationship with GF and OC, and some just never take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. contractor can earn a couple more points from supplier, manufacturers, what's out there?
Okay, well, that's a good question. I'll try to answer it without getting in trouble. But, look at it this way. When I've never really studied that because it's never been important to me from a distribution standpoint, because we have our rebate programs for contractors too. And what I find, and we're kind of in the middle of the food chain. We're getting rebates and we're giving rebates. Obviously, or hopefully we're getting more rebates than we're giving because we got to make money doing this. But the evolution of looking at where consumer rebates, contractor rebates from manufacturers, 20 years ago those didn't exist, and all of a sudden now they're a main part of your profitability at the contractor level, and they're necessary. You have to negotiate those things. What I've seen, the trend I've seen is going to a more consolidated. I think GAF has led this. I've just talking on what I've seen or what I've heard, where GAF used to negotiate rebates with contractors on a one-off basis. Now you just kind of go on their website, you know, you sign up for it, and whatever they offer is what you get. You know, they've kind of taken away that negotiation opportunity. Is that the start of a new trend? Probably in some manner, because there's so many of them out there. And you know, there's no advantage. You almost have to have it to run your business as a manufacturer now, where in the old days, you know, if you had a large contractor doing $20 million, who wanted to buy direct, you say, well, we're not going to sell you direct, but I'll tell you what, if you're loyal to me, and can get to a certain square level, we'll give you some money back, and that may have started with one or two contractors, but now everybody can get it. You just have to ask. That's why, again, the barrier to entry is too low in this business. Anybody can get those things. So, from a roofing contractor standpoint, where's the market advantage? There is no market advantage because everybody's getting them. So you're not. There's no advantage. So where is your loyalty as a contractor?
Is there such a thing as loyalty? I hear it from reps all the time. There's no loyalty. Contractors are not loyal.
I had a contractor tell me this the other day, and I'm still studying. I don't have the answer for you, but I'm studying this because that part is very important to me, because how do we find those market advantages on behalf of our membership group? But in a win-win circumstance, you know, we want to be the best customer of manufacturing distribution in the industry. So how do we find those market advantages? I honestly don't have an answer for you as to where your loyalty as a contractor should go. I don't know. But I had one guy tell me this the other day. He said, I used to be loyal to the badge, meaning, you know, the Master Elite or Platinum. I used to be loyal to the badge. Now I'm loyal to the dollar. And what he found was that, rather than leading with selling a manufacturer, you know, I'm a top tier manufacturer, because everybody can get there rather easily now, and his market advantage is gone. It's diluted, because, you know, if you're a consumer, you can have five Master Elites or eight Platinums. You can just go on their website and you can see all of them, and it's very difficult to set yourself apart, you know, to elevate yourself above that, you know. So he sells his company, and you know, he still has alignments, but he's loyal to, you know, I'm in this business to make money. I want to, you know, align myself with who can help me make the most money. So I think in that regard, if you found a manufacturer, I'll cite Atlas just because I know those guys and I love those guys. Atlas has some different stuff, you know, in this marketplace. You know, their alignment with 3M, you know, with their Scotchgard product. You know, that I think can help a consumer make more money, because or a contractor make more money, because they can go to a house, they see the algae streaks, they can say Scotchgard, that's a 3M product, that's, you know, 3M's here in town, you know, 3M, you know, if there's a manufacturer out there that's going to be congruent and aligned and mesh with my marketing program, that's going to help me, my company, look better, that's who I should align with. You know, I shouldn't just be a Platinum, because if I'm not and everybody else is, I might lose a job. Who can help me, you know, make more money? And I don't have that answer. I see every manufacturer doing something a little bit differently. Like, you know, Atlas did something with, you know, with Scotchgard. That's different. GAF does different things. Everybody just does something different. But what works for you in your marketplace? There's no set answer to that question. That's a good question, though.
I have one more question about manufactured products. Mm-hmm. I went through a lot of company tours, mm-hmm. manufacturer tours, mm-hmm. and at every manufacturer I've been at, they have piles of scraps. Like, you go in and the shingles that did not make the cut, mm-hmm. like lower quality control, right? But I have never ever heard about recalls. So once they shipped, I've never seen manufacturer recalling, like, you know, like in the auto industry, you make cars, mm-hmm. there's a small problem, boom, they're recalling 1,000 cars. Mm-hmm. In this industry, I see every single shingle that essentially sent to a supplier gets installed, and then 5-10 years later, mm-hmm. we have problems with the class actions, mm-hmm. and, you know, problems. Have you seen recalls?
Where a contract or where a manufacturer would actually be proactive and go to a consumer and say,
or to you and say, hey, this eight truck will have to come back because we have issue.
Well, we'll never like I've never seen that because you kind of said the key in there. You're not going to know if a shingle has a problem until 3, 5, 8 years down the road. Even in recalls, which is on, you know, with automobiles, you may get a recall.
But that's not true. That's not true. Like I've seen, like roofers see it all the time. Yeah. You open a bundle, you see high nail, you see glue. Okay. I mean, there is quite a few things. Like roofers see the damage. Roofers see like shingles pulling apart. They complain to their reps. Mm-hmm. The problem that I see with the quality of the products, even once manufacturer reps find out about it. I mean, I've showed a couple of reps like true problems. They never go back. They never investigate because they have a failure rate, which is like 0.5%, 1%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I feel like they're taking risk by dealing with it 5 years later. I don't think it's right, but I wanted to ask you as a supplier, have you ever seen it?
Well, Dan, the simple question is no. I've never seen them say,
recall,
these lot numbers in your warehouse or these colors, we need to get them back from you and we'll give you new stuff or we'll give you credit. I've never seen that. No, it's non-existent.
Another question.
I'm sure it's happened somewhere down the road. But we look at things like lot numbers to make sure the lot numbers.
Yep.
We don't want to mix a color from one factory with a color from another factory because we're worried about the colors not, matching. But if a shingle is made off off kilter a little bit like you've talked about, we'll get complaining. But it's usually probably in the factory. It's probably fixed in the same day, So it's maybe 1,000 squares, and once that's out in the marketplace, it just gets forgotten about. Yeah. Or it becomes a problem 5, 6, 7 years when the shingle starts failing, and then you're in the system by that time, and you know how that system goes.
Another question in that regard is, I have seen many times where product fails, usually winter installs, waves, and stuff like that, and manufacturer blames distributor for storing it wrong or double stacking. It's like the most common excuse. It's not a problem with the product. Product is perfect. It's supplier issue because they stack them and they should not stack them. Is a stacking is really a problem on the supplier end? Does it really mess up?
Well, if you look at asphalt, like in Minnesota, maybe not as much as maybe in Texas or Arizona, for instance, because because if you're leaving them outside, here we were told not to triple stack, not double stack. So double stacking was fine. Did we triple stack? Yeah, we did, because we only had so much space and they wanted us to buy a bunch of stuff to get the right discounts. And there are times that we did for a short amount of time. We might triple stack a little bit in the wintertime when it's not going to be an issue. But if we left a triple stack outside all summer, chances are that bottom, you're going to have some issues on that on those bottom shingles. Now, having said that, I don't know if manufacturers had hard set rules where thou shalt not do it this way. It might be a rule, but they can't really regulate how we do our business. They can just tell us not to.
Instruction is not to triple stack, same with us. Yeah. Like they can tell us how to install their product. I think they can tell supplier how not to triple stack.
I think they can, but if we did it anyway, how would they know unless there was a problem? And then, ultimately, if it got too big of a deal, they could sue us. They could pull the line from us. I've just never heard of any of that. Like I said,
we hear it all the time.
Yeah, where you see this is slow-moving inventory. So it probably wouldn't be Weatherwood. It would probably be like a green or a red or something like that, where it sits in the yard for 6, 8 months because it just doesn't move. And then your poor homeowner wants that shingle and it's been triple stacked in the back of the warehouse, getting heat on it for 6 months, and that's where you're going to have the problem. Shingles that move very, very quickly, we just never have that problem, even if we're triple stacking it. Now, having said that,
were there times going back in, 2006, 14 years ago, so the, did I do that? Would I advise any distributor to do that? No, not at all. I'm just saying that in distribution in general, there were times that we did that, and not saying it's right, but you kind of do as a distributor what you have to do. But now, I've never once, when I was triple stacking, I never once had a manufacturer's rep come into my office and because you could just see it out the, say, don't do that.
So they don't complain?
No, they don't complain. No. And again, it's, if something happens, it's real easy to point at the distributor, So, and you're not going to notice it for a few years, unless it's at the time of install where you can't peel them apart. But most contractors will probably still, because they're trying to get on and off the job, deal with it,
How do you deal with contractors, usually probably storm chasers more than retail or residential, who files bankruptcy, comes in, like it's big problem in the industry. So, people change names a lot, run for 1 or 2 years, change the name, and I notice the first thing is gonna go, or first thing they don't pay as supplier and then sales reps, because that's how they, contractor gets in a big financial hole, it's like, oh man, I'm $1 million negative. Good guys will try to get out of it, payment plans, do it the right way. Bad contractors just like burn it. On your end, I've heard contractors who don't pay $1 million. Do you have insurance for it, or is it just always a loss?
Well, like I said, if you're a distributor, you set aside a portion. You actually have an expense on your financial
bad
statement
debt.
For bad debt. And what we used to do is we'd roll that over. In other words, we'd develop a war chest. And this, I was a small distributor in the scope of the world. So let's say our bad debt for a year was $100,000, but we only wrote off $50,000. We would reduce that bad debt from $100,000 to $50,000. We would take the other $50,000 and we'd roll it over. So next year we'd start $50,000 ahead. And we would set aside either quarter to a half percent, or some years if business was good, we'd set aside a quarter. If business was bad, we'd set aside a half, because we know more contractors would go out of business. But so we started with $50,000. At the end of the year, if we had $150,000 in that bank, in that bucket, if we only had $100,000, then we'd still have $50,000. We kept rolling it over. So that's a smart business person, what they do. I would imagine, I know, because I worked for both Beacon and SRS at one point in time, that they account for bad debt. It's good GAAP accounting to do that. And hopefully you're following industry trends. You have a very good credit department, and you're going to have $1 million hit if you're an ABC supply. Those things happen out there, but you've accounted for it. I think on a contractor end of it, those things should make you angry, because if your focus is on why am I paying more money for my shingles, part of the reason is because we have to build in the fact that your competition isn't paying their bills at the distribution level. So to me, I'll say it again, most important thing a contractor can shout from the mountaintops is that he pays his bills. And if you know somebody out there that's not paying their bills, that guy should be ran out of town. Paying your bills means you're a good business person. Not paying your bills means you're not. That's out there for argument, because I know a lot of contractors might say, well, I've gotten trouble. I had legitimate things happen, but you know what? And I understand that, but everybody gets in trouble, but it's how you handle it. And like you say, I've dealt with storm chasers over the years that had worked their way out, and I've dealt with some guys that just would stop calling you and their phone's disconnected. Now you're getting down to a question of character. How do people handle those things? I couldn't live with myself if I didn't pay a bill. That's how I feel about my life. Not everybody feels that way.
If they don't pay the bills, like I see suppliers now getting more aggressive, liens going way more
absolutely.
Often.
And they should, yeah. And that's just the way of life, because contractors don't have a lot of capital. And you may sign a personal guarantee, but you may have $100,000 debt, but your personal worth is much less than that. So I've always been an advocate for strong credit policies, and I think it's good for the industry, because those that don't belong in the industry, that can't adhere to those credit policies in the contractor end, shouldn't be in the business. So I'm very strong about that I feel that you know, we should pay our suppliers, and we should make that part of our marketing program that we pay our bills.
Give me a couple crazy stories, like crazy stories from your days as a supplier. Mm. Maybe sophisticated scams or maybe some crazy creative ways how contractors try to screw you, or like I've heard stories where contractors, before they sign even contracts, they would deliver materials on the job site, for example, just so to lock in homeowner, do business with them. Share some stories with me.
From a scam standpoint?
Scam or interesting stories, funny maybe.
I guess this is the biggest scam would be maybe an ex-salesperson of a contractor would call in an order for a job. Mm-hmm. He'd say, I'm Fred with with Joe's Roofing.
I was always wondering about
yes, that. Yes, I'm on an order. And I think in this day and age, you know, technologies is harder, but this goes back 20 years. I'm Fred with Joe's Roofing. I want to order a job delivered to this address. And it might even be an address that Joe's Roofing is doing or going to do. The material would arrive. Fred, who's no longer working for Joe, would go out with his pickup truck and a couple guys, take the material, bring it to another job. We had that happening where the invoice would go to Joe, say, "Hey, you invoiced me twice." "No, well, you ordered twice." "No, I didn't." So that's one of the scams that I saw happen in the past. I think the funniest stories I could tell aren't necessarily in fraud, but you know, when you're delivering, sometimes we would deliver 200 roofs a day at Roof Depot, and sometimes things would go wrong. Like we would deliver the wrong color to a house, or we would deliver instead of to 2815 Aldrich, we'd deliver to 2815 Bedford, or 2815 Aldrich South versus Aldrich North. We deliver shingles to the wrong house, and the consumer would go, "Well, these don't belong." We would drop them on the ground, and they disappear, and we'd have to find them, or we deliver the wrong shingles. And I always got involved in those things personally when we delivered the wrong color shingles, because the contractor, the subcontractor shows up, he just bangs on whatever's there, right? So we pull the wrong shingles, and heather instead of weatherwood, or white instead of black, whatever it was. Homeowner comes home after working all day to see their new roof, and it's the wrong color. And, you know, you go back and find out the contractor ordered the right shingles. We delivered the wrong shingles.
And it happened to me once when I ordered from a Roof Depot. It's actually a funny one. A really good homeowner. We were doing four-car garage, but it was like 22 squares.
Yeah.
And we ordered the right color, materials were delivered the wrong color. And I remember I come in, like, the roof is done. Like, we were done by, like, 1 p.m., right. Easy roof. So I remember I called my sales rep, Matt, what was his last name?
Matt Critta?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
And so and he told me, "Dmitry, I give you two options. I can make it right, send you the right one, or you can just keep it, and we're even, like, you know, don't pay pretty much for this order."
Okay.
Something like that. And it was like $1,800 order. Mm-hmm. So I took, next thing what I did, I talked to the homeowner who hired me. It was four owners, but I made an offer to one who was in charge. And I said, "If you keep this color, I know it's wrong, but if you keep this color, I'll give you $1,000 off your invoice."
Yeah.
So I'm getting $1,800. And so, but it's easier than start over the whole thing, right? And the color was, I think it was like weatherwood and driftwood.
They weren't that far off.
It wasn't. Yeah. But still different color, and she took it. She's like, "Oh yeah, nice. I'll go shopping this weekend." So I gave her $1,000 off. Mm-hmm. Just being creative, thinking outside of the box.
Yeah.
You guys lost, obviously. You deliver materials, but I think for you, it still were cheaper than do it twice. Essentially, right. I don't know.
Things used to happen about once every 6 months, and I probably got involved in 5-10 of them over the course of when I ran the company. And what I would always do is whenever these things would happen, I got personally involved. And I would call up the contractor first off and say, "Well, you know how we do things. We're sorry. Can you give me your contact, the homeowner's name? I want to call them personally, apologize. I want to take this off your shoulder." So first thing I would do is I would take it off the contractor's shoulder. It wasn't his problem. I created the problem. I need to solve the problem. I call the homeowner, and I always start by saying, "Congratulations. What do you mean?" "Well, this happens to us about once every 6 months, and congratulations, your number came up. I know I'm being funny, and this is a problem, but I'm here to fix it." And up to and including tearing that roof off and putting a new roof on, I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to pay that price because I made a mistake, my company made a mistake, and we're going to solve it. But if there's a dollar number, that you can live with to keep that color, let me know what it is. As long as it's reasonable, I will hand deliver a check to your house by the end of the day.
How many people took the check?
All but one. And typically, now, one woman said, you could tell her, she's shuffling papers, you can hear it on the phone, and she finds her contract, and her contract was for $15,000. She wanted $15,000. She wanted the whole roof free. Ma'am, that's not reasonable. I'm going to call the contractor. We're going to start redoing your roof with the right colors tomorrow. And she went, oh, well, wait a minute. I think we settled for $3,000. But the typical dollar number that they came up with was like $1,000. So instead of me having to pay to redo the whole roof, they would $1,000. So what I would typically do is I would get a check for $1,000. I said, what time are you going to be home? 6 o'clock. I'm going to come by your house at 6 o'clock. I had a little release form that, you know, one sentence, real simple. I release you. I know the shingles were delivered wrong, but I release you. Please sign the release, and here's the check, and here's a $100 gift certificate for, you know, a restaurant down the street. I always stop and get a gift certificate of a restaurant nearby just for being good people. And you know what? We got so much mileage from the, from that type of attitude rather than trying to blame it somewhere else. But again, you screw up, you fix it, you move on. You make your customer happy because you're taking it off your shoulders. You make the consumer happy because they're getting something out of it. And what I found is most people are reasonable. Like they were reasonable. $1,000 off, you know, you end up making money on the thing. You just have to say, I screwed up, I want to fix it. And then they kind of look at you as a human being rather than somebody that ruined their day.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like on the supplier end, that's actually not the probably biggest issue. Biggest issue I feel like dealing with suppliers is drivers, mm-hmm. mailboxes, driveways.
Oh, well, okay. I'll tell you a funny story. Oh, God, I shouldn't hear. Okay, you want to hear a funny story?
Sure.
It was a storm damage time. Drivers are busy. They don't even have time to have lunch, let alone go to the bathroom somewhere. Okay. So, you know, we're making a delivery. The driver forks the stuff up. He's really got to go. He goes behind the behind the house, and nobody's looking. He goes to the bathroom. Only Gladys Kravitz across the alleyway was watching him, and apparently he urinated on a prize rose bush, because I got the phone call that night, or that the next morning, or that afternoon. Your driver just peed on our prize rose bush that's worth $1,000, and you're going to pay for our prize rose bush. And I went, what? So I figured out who the driver was, you know, and I went to the driver and said, did you do this? And he kind of looked at me and goes, Earl, I think I might have. But, you know, we kind of do those things once in a while because we're busy. I get it, but it was a prize.
How do you deal with that?
And who knows if it was a prize rose bush or not. But the fact is, I had a driver that urinated on somebody's property, and I had to pay $1,000 for a prized rose bush.
That's embarrassing.
It was embarrassing, and, you know, I cut the driver a little bit of slack and just said, look, you know, as busy as you are, I will make sure that you have time to go to the bathroom at the correct way, at the correct place.
How many driveways did you pay for?
Oh, hundreds. Hundreds. Yeah, and we had a whole driveway fix-it kit out back. You know, we had a bunch of asphalt and a hammer thing, and a lot of times we would send somebody out and take a look at it, and a lot of times we could just fix it, and we would.
You know what the Roof Depot paid for? You did pay for a couple of driveways working with us, but you paid your driver backed in our dump trailer, mm-hmm. and completely demolished the neck. It's not the gooseneck, just like where the bolt goes in.
Okay.
So completely destroyed it.
Yeah.
So we couldn't even hook up the...
Couldn't move it.
Yeah. So I took a picture, sent it to my sales rep, like, your driver did it. He's like, I'm on it. And by the end of the day, he went, got a part, like it's bolted, like big triangle,
yeah.
And he replaced the whole thing. He's like, I'm going to fix it by the end of the day.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah. Mailboxes. I can't tell you how many new mailboxes I bought. Fixing the yards. You know, like the outriggers would come out and, you know, and press down, and, you know, consumers would say, I get a picture emailed to me,
big square.
It's like, well, what do you want me to do with that? You know, so we had to send out a landscaping guy that would go out and have to dig up the soil and lift it up and whatever they did. But it would be a $500 bill
for me to send somebody out. It's just, you know what that is, Dimitri, that's just cost of doing business. And fortunately for us, we had many more success stories than failures in the 20 years or so, or 16 years that we had the business. And it was a hell of a ride, and I enjoyed every minute.
Is it true that Home Depot sued you guys for having Depot in the name?
Yeah, if they did, I never got to my desk, and it probably would have. No, we were actually Roof Depot before Home Depot was Home Depot.
Oh, really?
We incorporated in like 1987, and I think Home Depot was like 1989 or something like that. No, they're actually, Home Depot was a big customer of ours. You know, they used to have at-home service where they would do roof installs. They've discontinued that now, but we did at-home service, and we did the do-it-yourself for business. Like if somebody walked into a store and wanted a shingle, Home Depot didn't have it in stock, they would call us up. And typically those are Saturday deliveries, and we'd have a guy on the roof looking like me that would be unloading bundles. We hated that business because you're dealing with not contractors that knew what they were doing at that point in time. But no, that's not true. We never got sued.
It was a rumor I heard. The last question I have is, give one advice to brand new contractor who just filed LLC yesterday, about to start negotiating prices with suppliers and manufacturers. Pick up a brand, and he's brand new, so he probably expects price not to be aggressive, or maybe he doesn't know how much he should pay, and he's going to have a lot of salespeople knock on his door, because the moment you file LLC, you become a target for all local businesses who can sell to you.
I used to use those as my lead, my leads, those LLC things that would come out.
Yep. So give advice to a brand new company.
Pick your salesman wisely. Without them knowing it, interview multiple salespeople. You know, see the one that fits you. I would, I guess if I was a, the one thing I learned about contractors is, when you had a guy just walk into your place for the first time, a year from now, he could be your best customer, and your biggest customer, best customer. If I was in that position today with what I know, if I was a new guy starting my business, I would walk in, and once I found that sales guy that I really liked, I'd sit down with him and I'd say, I want to be your best customer. How can we together do that? I want to be your best customer. I want to pay my bills on time. And I think that's the other advice, we talked about that. Pay your bills on time. I want to be your best customer. You know, make the guy feel special that you came to him. But I'm naive. I need somebody that can nurture and coach me. You know, let your guard down. Can you help me to be your best customer by helping me to find those market advantages that it's going to take me years to find, but can you help me get there? And I think I know salespeople in this town, that's not what they're used to hearing. They're going to go, oh my God. And first off, going to think you're crazy, but if they really listen, they're going to go, wow, this guy really has his act together. I want him as my customer.
Yeah. Great advice. Mm-hmm. I remember when I started in this business, I felt like everybody's trying to take advantage of me. I remember my very first order with United Products. I sold 27 square EPDM roof, and I ordered through United Products, didn't know anything, didn't know pricing, so I placed the order, and sales rep gave me a price at $11.50 for 60 mil EPDM, and I remember walking in the Menards and seeing the roll of EPDM at $6.79. And I got pissed. I'm like, it's more than double. It's walk-in price. He must, like, same brand even, Carlisle, I believe. Mm-hmm. So I call him. I was like, how come I'm seeing it here at $6.79 and I see it on your invoice for $1,100? Do you want my business or not? And I did very similar to what you just said. I came in because my buddy, my best friend, siding installer, told me he buys everything from there. So when I call him, I said, like, you were the sales rep for my best friend. He'd been doing business with you for the last 5 years. And now I just moved to Minneapolis. And he said, let me fix it. And he did. He went from $1,100 to, he not only matched the price, he beat the Menards price from $6.79 to $6.74. And I remember asking myself, why this guy could not do it in the first place? Why did it take me to do the research? You know, and for me, I felt like he was $100 more, it's one thing. But when it's double the price, the price was so different. It was so unfair. Yeah. And to this day, I remember his name. I mean, I still, like, I set up my account and I told him, I want you to fight for my business. I want you to want my business. I don't want to shop around mm-hmm. for every product. I want to make sure I pay fair price. Mm-hmm. It was just not fair. And yeah. it kind of like...
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, there by the grace of God go I when I had my distribution business. You mentioned it was United Products. Could have been Roof Depot just as easy. Yeah. And, you know, because we try to keep those list prices up. Because we do have do-it-yourself business, people that sure. walk in sure. just want to roll, and if they don't ask, they're going to get what a good customer of mine called the tourist price. You know, and he used to always say, Earl, you're not giving me the tourist price on this, are you? I go, Jerry, no, I never give you the tourist price, even though I may have sometimes did. But, you know, and that just, I'm glad it was a positive at the end of the day, and I hope that you gave them a lot more business, didn't hold it against them. But yeah, we put ourselves in that, you know, in that area. I always would, you know, I put limits on my salespeople as far as what they could discount products to. They couldn't go below a certain level without letting me know. But there was a lot of room for them. And if you didn't ask, if you just walked in and ordered it, that was going to happen. That's going to happen anywhere. So that's where, again, getting back to what we just talked about and your very important question, is very... The most important thing a new contractor can do is find a sales guy he knows, he trusts, he likes, that can become, you know, maybe not, you know, maybe not his friend, but friendly with, and that when he's, you know, when he looks at the phone and sees you come up on his phone, he's happy to answer and he's not going, oh God, you know. So again, finding that win-win. This is a partnership we're forming. You want me to succeed in my business. You require me to make money because that's how I pay my bills to you. I require you to make money. That's how I know you're going to be here tomorrow. Having that kind of attitude. We all have to make money in the supply chain.
Well, the thing about tourist prices,
yes.
it has, I think, a lot of suppliers lose business later. Because
yes.
if you gave me tourist price, next thing your competition coming in and saying, and give me aggressive price because they recognize
yeah.
me, they see my trucks, they see my yard signs, where are you buying your materials from? Mm-hmm. ABC. All right, here's my price list. And now you see you're mm-hmm. paying tourist price and here you can save 10%. And now, like, we don't want to always, we want to treat you guys mm-hmm. with respect, but when we have this happening, mm-hmm. well, why this guy could not do this?
Mm-hmm.
And now we go with this often mm-hmm. without telling this guy because we...
But Dimitri, in that scenario that you just went with the rolls of 60 mil EPDM, your learning curve was very, very short mm-hmm. because you saw a better sure. price out there. So in other words, the consumer can see all the pricing. It's very transparent. You got a hold of somebody and you found really quickly not only did he, you know, did he meet the price? He beat the price. And all of a sudden now you realize it's just a matter of me talking to the right person at each of these. You know, you learn really quick how the business works. I got to get a hold of a salesperson, and I got to make sure I've got good pricing, and I got to call these guys on it to make sure I'm always buying good. You know, and, you know, so it was one problem issue that when you recognize it was a problem, you saw, everything was out there for you to solve in about probably 30 minutes or an hour. You made a couple phone calls. You got money in your pocket.
Absolutely.
And the good part about that is because there is competition. Like I said, there by the grace of God go I, and I'm sure those things have happened to me when I ran my distribution business. But by God, those are nightmare scenarios for me. That how many guys like you would never come back? I don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How do we join your organization, and why would anyone join it? Is there sign-up fees? What do we get? What are the benefits? Really quick.
It's a long conversation. So how do you? I just can't say. I'll send you the link, and you can join. What we recognized when we put this together, this is something I've been thinking about for 20 years, and it was my idea that I brought to FEI Group, the CEO, David Giesling, who unfortunately passed away this year, saw the same vision I did. And I brought this to other people, and nobody's ever seen the vision. But what we recognize is the barrier to entry being too small in this industry. Yet, like I talked about earlier, that there's a certain group of contractors out there that are great entrepreneurs, very smart business people, you know, are very good at what they do, but realize I better always be getting better. And they also realize that, you know, there's strength in numbers and guys that work well with others and want to have fun doing it, you know, that like being around other contractors. So of 40,000 contractors, is maybe 400 that would fit that category. And we have, you know, we have a high barrier to entry as far as revenues, as far as, you know, how you operate your business. Of those 400, there might be 200 that culturally is a good fit, because you have to have the right mindset. You know, if you think you know everything in business, we're not your place, because our members don't know everything, but hopefully they can learn everything they need to know by grouping together. And that's the kind of guys that we're looking for. And, you know, today we have 43. We're about $1.5 billion in aggregate revenue. So you can kind of, you know, do the math backwards and see that our average size member is probably something around 30 million or so. So it's a larger, more
sophisticated. What do they get in return besides, you know, network together? I mean, mm-hmm. Any buying powers yet?
Yeah, we negotiate incentives on their behalf over and above what they do on their own. And I think the other thing that we do is give them a national voice, market intelligence, try to keep them on the cutting edge of what's going on. You know, is that 7% price increase really going to be 7, or is it going to be 3 or 2 or none? Or is price going to be going down? Because we watch trends and try to make them the smartest consumers out there in the roofing industry. So, we share best practices, and in which case there might be some purchasing discussions as far as how do we better buy as a group together and such like that. But from a pure dollar standpoint, what we negotiate on their behalf is on an individual basis very small. They'll get a dividend check for being a part of our group. It's certainly not going to be anything that they're going to retire off of, but you know, the group does pay for itself. But it's all those other things, the networking, the best practices, the ability, and the way I look at it is this: anything that any contractor desires to do but doesn't have the time, the bandwidth, the money to do it on his own, but it's a good idea, but he just can't do it on his own, like a national managed repair program owned and operated by contractors. Now, I'm not saying we're doing that, but those are things we've talked about. A national lead generating program that, instead of an Angie's List or Home Advisors, is something that contractors put together. You know, you're doing something similar, and I think what you're doing is wonderful, and it's a great thing. You know, those type of things where one contractor can't do it on his own, but in a group, they can do wonderful things. And what our group does, we're a management company. We manage 5 successful contractor groups in the plumbing, flooring, and now roofing business, is we do all the heavy lifting. The contractors, we're driven by our members. They come to us and say, we have this idea, you know, can we put together the program to do this? So we go out and put it together, because contractors' main business is putting roofs on every day. So if they have an idea for a managed repair program or something, we take that task on. We'll put together committees, we'll do the research, we'll fund it if we need to, and those funds will come from our suppliers that basically fund what we do. We reinvest that money on their behalf, because at the end of the day, we want to be their best customer, and that's the kind of relationships that we want to build with our supplier partners. Does that make sense, I hope?
Yes, yeah. Yes, makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming, opening our eyes on what's going on behind the doors. I mean, it's a closed world, you're right. It's a complicated relationship between suppliers and manufacturers, and we need to become a better buyers and more intelligent.
Yeah. Well, partners. You know,
yes.
Look at your suppliers as partners, and you want to be their best customers, a win-win. And I think, you know, you will find the opportunities from the supplier standpoint just open up for you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate you.